The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Okay, welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. Today we're going to have kind of a mixture, a collection of voices about drug reform, about pain in today's America. And we'll hear from Mr. Mark Emery about his arrest and potential extradition to the United States for selling marijuana seeds. But first up, I want to share some voices from last week's Journey for Justice rally across from the White House in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. with John Flaha. John, tell us what brings you to this Journey for Justice March.
My heart brought me to this Journey for Justice March here in D.C. I believe that the justice system is far from that right now. We've got over 2 million people in prison, and I'm a firm believer that they all don't need to be there. And I'm hoping that by coming here and using my voice to motivate others and get others involved and educate the people that maybe don't want to get involved to the what is actually happening with the justice system as far as the sentencing and the abuse, it needs to be addressed. And my heart drove me here, and I speak from my heart, and because the change has to happen before it affects all of us. The bottom line is it is affecting us right now. Taxpayers are paying money to keep guys in prison with harsh draconian sentences that don't need to be there when it could be going to other places like education, veterans. So my heart's got me here. I'm not going to make a difference, but I'm going to be part of what does make the difference.
Round of applause to Sister Afia. Yeah.
For justice! You know, the last time I was here in this park on such a relevant issue was in 1998, March 27, 1998, with a demonstration that was called the Jericho Movement for Recognition and Amnesty for the political prisoners in the United States of America. The United States, just like every other country around the world, has people that it is criminalized, incarcerated, and tortured and abused from Attica to Abu Ghraib, just like every other government. And we're here to say today, we're not silent anymore. We have family members here, and we have folk here, particularly Veronica Bowers, who is held by the government of the United States of America, held in Coleman Prison in Florida, done 30 years, eligible for mandatory release, and has been continuously held despite that release date of April 7th.
I was talking to a young lady, a spokesman for Mr. Eddie Conway. Your name is?
Shayna Robinson, Baltimore, Maryland.
Shayna, what's the story about Mr. Conway?
Basically, Eddie Conway was a former Black Panther Party leader in Baltimore, Maryland, and about 35 years ago, he was tried and convicted of killing a police officer and wounding another. Actually, he was a victim of the counterintelligence program by the FBI back in the 70s, and he's been locked up for 35 years for that conviction.
What do you think of this gathering? What can we do? What more can we do?
I think it's great. I think that, you know, getting together and spreading the word about different organizations and different things, agendas that people have going on, signing petitions, getting the word out, just sort of a place to come and lobby and you know, make our voices heard.
With the strains of Midnight Special playing in the background here in Washington, D.C., I'm pleased to talk with an associate of Prison Families Anonymous, Jayette. What brings you to this organization?
My son that's locked away in New York State.
And tell us the nature of the charge and the sentencing.
attempted assault. He was told 19 months by the court. 9 years later, he's still there, but no recorded release date.
President of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, CJPF.org, Mr. Eric Sterling.
There are 8 stages in the movement. We're not at the first stage, which is where just business goes as usual. That was back in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was president. By the end of the 80s, we already had a movement that was growing. And we're not in the second stage where we were proving the failure of the official institutions, because that was already becoming clear in the early 1990s when the Sentencing Commission was saying mandatory sentences are racist, mandatory sentences don't work. We're past the second stage. The third stage is as the conditions get worse and our movement grows more and more. You've got groups like Families Against Mandatory Minimums and the Justice Policy Institute and the Drug Policy Alliance and the Sentencing Project and the ACL Prison Project. And more, the public sees the faces of the victims. We're way past the third stage. We're in the fourth stage right now. And that's the takeoff stage. That's the stage that involves the triggering events. Events which project this issue onto the front pages and into the lead stories of the news broadcast. That's not the end of it, because that's only the fourth of the 8 stages. There's a fifth stage that we have to work out and be careful about. The fifth stage is the perception of failure. The fifth stage is when we get disillusioned. The fifth stage is when we look around on a steamy, hot Saturday in August and say, where the hell is everybody? Where the hell is all the money? That's when we get disillusioned. And that's a stage we have to recognize that we go through, because it's only a misperception. It's not the reality. Because the sixth stage is right around the corner. The sixth stage is when we have the majority of the public opinion. And the public knows mandatory sentences is bullshit. The public knows our prisons are hellholes. The public knows too many people are in prison who do not belong there and never should have been there. We are close to success, but we need to work hard. We need to follow the right rules of effective movement organizing. We need to do what we're supposed to do. We need to commend people like Roberta Franklin, who put her ass on the line to get this demonstration out here. I want to thank you so much, and all the people who've been here. This has been a great day, and I am so proud I can stand here before you today and say, you're the heroes. You're the heroes, and my hat's off to you. Thank you, and God bless you.
Next, you'll hear from Bonnie Furness.
We hear from women testifying about being forced to engage in sexual acts, giving birth shackled, and dying of untreated breast cancer. We hear from men who have spent 15 years or more in isolation, often suffering the use of devices of torture like restraint chairs, shackles, stun belts, stun guns, spit hoods, pepper spray. Some of the saddest letters I get are from prisoners writing on behalf of the mentally ill, like the man who spread feces over his body. The guard's response to this was to put him in a bath so hot it boiled 30% of the skin off of him. In 2000, the United Nations Committee on Torture cited the U.S. use of isolation, stun belts, and restraint chairs as violating the U.N. Convention Against Torture. U.S. prison practices also violate the U.N. Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, the U.N. Convention on the Rights of the Child, and a dozen other treaties. U.S. prison practices also fit the United Nations definition of genocide. If you are poor and a youngster of color in this country and look around at what is happening to men, women, and children of your nationality, it is hard not to conclude that an economic and physical genocide is being committed. We are victims of an ideology of inhumanity on which this country was built. If we dig deeper into U.S. prison practices, the political function they serve is inescapable.
That's right.
Police, the courts, the prison system, and the death penalty all serve as social control mechanisms. The economic function they serve is equally as chilling. The 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution guaranteed prison slavery. Abu Ghraib taught us that the Department of Corrections is more than a set of institutions. It's a state of mind, and one that we're exporting. We need to alter the core of every system that slavery, racism, and poverty has given birth to, particularly the criminal justice system. We must fight to stop violating the human rights of men, women, and children. We need to decriminalize poverty and mental illness. The AFSC recognizes the existence and expansion of the penal system as a crisis that allows children to be demonized and a crisis that legitimizes torture, isolation, and abuse of power. I know each time we send a child to bed hungry, that is violence. That wealth concentrated in the hands of the few at the expense of the many is violence. That denial of dignity based on race, class, or sexual preference is violence. And that poverty and prisons are state-manifested violence. Like Sweet Honey says, we who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. Roberta, thank you from all of us for including us in this journey.
I'm here with Tom Angel of Students for Sensible Drug Policy. What's your take? What have we learned here today?
Well, I'm here representing the students of this country, and students are tired of seeing public resources go towards the prison industrial complex and away from important things like our financial aid and our access to education. And you know, students are tired of seeing our peers sent to brand new prisons and old, dilapidated schools. We're real tired of it. We need a reallocation of public resources. We need to put the emphasis on education and rehabilitation versus incarceration.
You have many associate groups around the country. How many do you have at this point?
SSDP has about 115 chapters on college and high school campuses nationwide. We have a national office here in Washington, D.C. with 4 full-time staff members.
If folks wanted to learn more, to get involved, what would they do?
People can go to www.daregeneration.com to find out more about SSDP, find out how to start up a chapter, or if there's a chapter at your school.
Okay, August 13th, we're here in front of the White House. The Journey for Justice event has just ended, and I'm here with David Borden of DRCNet.
It was really good to see people from different kinds of groups coming together for an event like this that I've not really seen before. So I think there's a lot of work going on by a lot of different kinds of people that we need to try to be aware of so we can work with them.
All right. And your website?
StopTheDrugWar.org.
Fighting for justice from the north and from the south. Journey for justice from the east and from the west.
That wraps up the Century of Lies coverage of the recent Journey for Justice rally in Washington, D.C. I want to thank Roberta Franklin, the main organizer, for the outstanding job she did in bringing us all together. You can hear more about this conference on the Cultural Baggage Show, as well as on next week's 420 Drug War News Reports. And might I suggest you visit the website of the November Coalition, november.org, or of journeyforjustice.org. It's time to play Name That Jurisdiction by Its Drug Law. In recognition of the UN Anti-Drug Day, this country held a huge gathering at a stadium for the execution of 57 people for drug crimes. Each year, they execute thousands of people in order to save them from oblivion. They yearn to please the American drug warriors in China. All right, now we continue with our ongoing series, A Look at Pain in Today's America.
All right, well, I'm Greg Wilkinson. I live up in Billings, Montana. I was injured 3 years ago, and I ended up with the over-the-counter prescription drugs that were doing me absolutely no good, and I went to see Dr. Richard A. Nelson here, who was a neurologist and specialized in the treatment of pain management. And he was the only doctor and the first doctor that had attempted to use narcotics to control the pain, so that I would be able to return to work and have an active, functional life. April 20th, of course, he was raided by the Drug Enforcement Administration. His certificate was pulled, and I watched not only myself, but hundreds of people be thrown into the street with nowhere to go, no doctors, no facilities, nowhere to go. And I happened to be one of those patients. So I got involved with Pain Relief Network, spearheaded petition drives against the Drug Enforcement Administration, and found out during that time that they had actually gone to area clinics and doctors with a geographic mile of 100 miles from Billings and threatened physicians not to treat any of Nelson's patients because the government pretty well looked at chronic pain patients as addicts, as substandard citizens. So the doctors in the areas around here, they shut their doors to us, leaving us without any adequate pain treatment at all.
Greg, this is not just a singular story. This is being perpetrated across America. Dozens, if not hundreds, of doctors have been threatened, many arrested, their practices destroyed. It's a national problem, is it not?
Yes, it is a national problem. In fact, we've got 32 states on March 21st of this year, as you well know, the NAG conference, National Attorney Generals, 32 states signed a letter to the Drug Enforcement Administration in Washington, D.C. over this specific problem. And yet we've got a cowardice government that is not taking the appropriate steps to stop the federal government from purposely interceding, into people's pain crisis. We have an administration that's saying we've got a huge Social Security crisis going on, and what the administration fails to recognize is that that crisis is basically due to the untreated or non-treated pain. If they would treat people with the correct drugs, then we wouldn't have a Social Security crisis. People would be able to work instead of filing for their Social Security. It's a catch-22, the whole mess is. Even the recent changes in the federal bankruptcy law. 99% of those people file bankruptcy not because they've gone shopping sprees, it's because the medical bills are killing them. And it's for untreated pain. These people keep going to doctors and getting these Ultram and Neurontin and drugs that don't work, but the doctors are afraid to treat the people with the medications that do work. And so if they're afraid to do that, the poor people like myself, they end up disabled and unable to work.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that it is their policy that creates the problems that they use as excuses to maintain their policy.
That's basically right. And all it takes is just somebody, some brave soul, some senator to actually follow through. We do have a Senate Judiciary Committee. Why they have not launched an investigation into the Drug Enforcement Administration's policies is beyond me. And why 32 state attorney generals would sit down and put ink in their pens and sign a document scathing, just a scathing document against the Drug Enforcement Administration for their fear tactics and scare tactics upon doctors to treat people adequately for pain, and yet none of those attorney generals have stepped up to the plate and spent the $1 million and filed an injunction against the Drug Enforcement Administration, who basically walks into every state, oversees and supersedes the state's sovereign rights to adequately monitor their own doctors. As you know, every state's got a state medical board, and yet those state medical boards are quashed. We're paying taxpayer dollars to keep these people in office, to keep these state medical board licenses, bureaus, and we're paying their salaries as well, and yet the government walks in and says, sorry, you don't have any jurisdiction, we're taking over. And all it takes is one state to step up and file an injunction, and it's my belief that the other states that sign these documents would follow through with the same type of behavior and say, you know, get out of the state. We have a right to police our own doctors. We don't need you policing our doctors for us. And it's a catch-22. It's a horrible, horrible situation, and it's all the way from the top. It's from the highest office that we have in our government, which is right up in the White House.
Well, Greg, does it not really boil down to the day when we let the medical profession take care of a medical problem and take it away from these cops?
That's just it. And now not only are the doctors the police, but the pharmaceutical, the pharmacy, the local pharmacy, the little man, the little old man at the end of the street here on the corner who's been in business for 50 years, now he's becoming a police officer. They've got him calling in and saying, well, you know, we're getting too many prescriptions to this guy. I mean, a medical doctor anymore, I believe, should be required to take his post-training, which you know is a police officer special training course, before he gets his medical degree. Because the medical doctors are becoming police officers. The pharmacists are becoming police officers. Whatever happened to the doctor being able to treat his patient, as in the old days, adequately for his pain, to stop the pain? It's a catastrophe. It's a travesty. We're entering a police government, a doctor police government, and it has nothing to do with diversion. I don't believe it does. I don't believe it has anything to do with the prescription drugs in the street being sold. I don't believe that at all. I think that basically anyone in pain is a substandard citizen, and that's how the government perceives them.
Greg, if folks want to learn more about this situation, where might they go on the web?
Well, they can go to painreliefnetwork.org, President Siobhan Reynolds, based out of New York City. They can also go to drdeluca.com, lowercase, drdeluca.com. He's got a wonderful history lesson on the web as well.
This is a call to crusaders in every state and county. Snitch out your friends, make rich folks grin, and earn an ample bounty. Eternal drug war is God's will. Our chains can set us free. More prisons, guards, and guns protect our liberty. If the rate of escalation in the U.S. war against drugs continues at the same rate until the year 2050, every American citizen will be behind bars, except those wearing a badge. Canada's Mark Emery, some call the Prince of Pot, was arrested a couple of weeks back for selling marijuana seeds to Americans. It seems the DEA wants to extradite him to stand trial and face sentencing up to life in prison.
Well, Mark, I want to say if there's a conspiracy to overthrow the government, to overgrow.
Yeah, that's right. See, overthrow implies violence, whereas overgrow implies the peaceful use of botany. And I love the term overgrow the government. It's so very appropriate to our struggle. We're being dealt with by a Nazified paramilitary organization like DEA, you know, and they round people up and their guns and their black uniforms and threaten to kill people and incarcerate America and incarcerate Canada, versus those of us who would cultivate a wonderful, beneficent plant. You know, the contrast is stark. And fortunately, I'm getting the opportunity to make that case to America. I was just covered in the New York Times on Saturday, and on Sunday, AOL.com had a massive poll of 72,000 people, and 70% of people, including mostly Americans, thought I should not be extradited. In Canada, we just had an official poll of 1,000 people by the Globe and Mail, and 58% of Canada thought I shouldn't be extradited. The Justice Minister, everywhere he goes, is being hounded about my case. And of course, since the Justice Minister who rules on whether I should be extradited is also the Attorney General who probably launched this investigation, there is a horrible conflict there. And so we're in for interesting times. But it's good that there's worldwide demonstrations being planned September 10th to the 15th around the world on my behalf. And if anything, we finally achieved what I could not get to happen, which was unity in our movement. There's a great deal of solidarity out there right now between all peoples in the cannabis culture. And I've finally gotten the people involved and engaged in this issue who don't smoke marijuana and who had always frustrated me, never couldn't be motivated to try and end the prohibition. So in Canada, it's got people thinking, wow, this American incursion into our country is really severe and dangerous.
I think the cannabis culture, the folks you speak of, are part of that, quote, conspiracy to overgrow the government, and yours truly included. I want to say that you have indeed benefited the movement. In America, you've helped me in the past. You've helped dozens, if not hundreds, of us.
You know, I got a lovely call from Jack Herrera's wife today. She said, Mark, this is Tina. I want to give you $100, she said. And she said, and I'm so thankful, Mark, that when Jack was ill, you gave money for his medical bills when almost no one else did, she said. And I'll never forget that, right? And stuff like that brings tears to my heart that, A, I could pay Jack Herrera back at some point for his wonderful work that got me into this movement in 1990 when his book was banned in Canada. And we imported it and sold it and started breaking that ban, which we eventually overturned in court in 1995. But to hear Jack Herrera's wife call me up and thank me for helping them, that was very, very touching. And I've always been proud of all the Americans I helped, hundreds and hundreds. You know, Webster Alexander, the young man who got 36 years sentenced for selling 2 1-ounce amounts of pot to an undercover agent in his home, which happened to be within 3 kilometers of a school, a playground and a school, so he got this incredible... See, after we, you know, got the worldwide media to come to a sentencing review, the Rolling Stone magazine and a variety of newspapers, you know, the judge said it's not because of all this media scrutiny, but then they lowered his 36-year sentence to 1 year to be served on weekends. And, you know, that boy is out and about, I would say, and free for 35 years due to our interventions, which were frequent and often throughout North America, and certainly in the United States, every state I spent money on their activist campaigns, whether it's the Jacksonville Hemp Fest or the Florida, you know, Journey for Justice or Texas Journey for Justice or Alabamians for Compassionate Use or Medical Bills for Jack Herrera. You know, we were always, always there to help, and whenever we could, we did.
Well, when Cultural Baggage was maybe going to move under the bridge, it was Mark Emery that helped us last summer, and I thank you for that, sir.
Hey, thanks, and it was a great investment, which is the whole point. You know, we just give enough money for people to get established, and a lot of people just take off once they get that the initial, you know, that initial seed germination going on. They get the idea, get the money in there, just enough to get them going. And I dare say many things we contributed in the early days, like Marijuana Policy Project. We gave them money when there were no big millionaires giving them money and helping them survive. And, you know, everybody, global marijuana marches have been paid in substance for 6 years by us, you know, in minimum $15,000 a year to $40,000 a year. And individual marches around the world have often been financed in Bologna, in Rome, in London, England. You know, we've helped sponsoring Warsaw, Poland. You know, we gave $2,000 to the Israeli Green Leaf Party, their marijuana party there in the 2003 elections. So, you know, it's huge, the list of people we have helped in pot politics and pot ballot initiatives in Alaska and Arizona and Washington, D.C. Gave money to all those, and sometimes very large amounts, too, and was proud to do so and will not deny doing so now. So the thing is, evidence-wise, you know, there's the case against me is pretty transparent. I did it. I'm proud I did it. I don't regret doing it. I would keep doing it if I could do it. And it needs to be done no matter whether you're going to put me in jail for it. And, there, you know, let's not fool ourselves. We're talking life imprisonment without parole here, which is like a death sentence to me, if not the outright death sentence that they could give me if I were a U.S. citizen.
Well, Mark, for those who have benefited from your assistance in the past, and for those who appreciate the work you do, it is time to pony up. Is there a way they could get in touch with your organization and help?
Yeah, they can find out what's going on as well as donate by going to cannabisculture.com, and there's a little box right in the middle of it that says if you want to donate by Visa, MasterCard, please do so. I would say send letters, keep active politically. You know, Americans and Australians and people all over the globe are getting entrapment notices from the DEA or from Australian police or Canadian police acting in concert. They photocopied about 3 weeks of our outbound mail as it was going through the post office, and they're now sending scam notices to these people, getting them to wire money to a police operative to get them to incriminate themselves in regards to having ordered seeds. Go to the cannabisculture.com website and take a look at the scam that the DEA is still perpetuating to get people as part of this investigation. They want to bust hundreds of people and growers worldwide as a consequence of monitoring the last couple of months of my business. So it's important that not only people can give money to me, but they can keep up to date on the latest dirty tricks from the DEA and the Canadian government, the United States government. All these governments are collaborating. They're all out to destroy their people, our people.
Join us next week when we'll be reporting from the International Methamphetamine Conference in Salt Lake City. I want to make note of the fact that the Drug Truth Network just picked up their 39th affiliate, WRPI, in Troy, New York. I want to say a special hello to WXOJ in Northampton, Massachusetts, the first affiliate to pick up Century of Lies.
In closing, there is no justice, no logic, no scientific fact, no religious underpinnings, no moral clarity, no reason whatsoever for this drug war to continue another second. The drug lords run both sides of this equation. We've been duped. Please become part of the solution. Dare to speak the truth. Prohibito istoc ivalesco.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Guffman.